Welcome to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys and a Podcast is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to determine what's significant to your future and why. What's up, man? How you doing?
Doing pretty good. Bright.
Right.
Ready to rumble.
And early on a Sunday morning.
I know.
We usually record this on a weeknight. We're up. There's some scheduling because of some convention business coming ahead. So we're out, so committed to this product that we fought our hangovers and all the other things that we had to fight off to be here bright and early. And then we got a very special guest crew with us who looks more hungover than any of us. And he still made it out to Brooklyn to be with us. My good friend, Waz. Tell them about yourself, man.
Yo, what's up? My name is Waz. I do a podcast.
Full name.
My full name. Oh, my God.
Yeah, okay. I got to give you full. Yeah,
My name is Wozni Lambre.
You want a beer?
As you can tell, it's a very ethnic name. My parents are Haitian immigrants, so you can thank them for how black that name is. But yeah, my name is Wozni Lambre, Big Woz on Twitter.
Yep, at Big Woz,
I'll be linked to it. Yeah, I do a podcast with ESPN's True Hoop where we just talk about basketball, general topics. Sometimes we get into pop culture stuff. Sometimes we actually talk about the game, but, you know, it's pretty fun. And, yeah.
And you write for some places too, right?
I do some freelance work for Complex every now and again. But for the most part, we just do the pod now.
Cool. All right, Waz. We've been talking about you coming on for a long time, man. I'm glad we finally made it happen.
Overdue.
I'm excited. I'm a big fan of the show.
Appreciate it, man. Appreciate it. So, as you know, being a fan, we got to get to the brand F up of the week. Of course, we got super producer Matt Leck. We got the power behind the throne, intern Charmaine. And we're going to get to the brand F up of the week. And, gentlemen, I know there's conflict in the room here because I know that some people in the room who shall remain nameless, Matt, are Trump supporters. And so it's a little awkward.
Build the wall.
Anyways, we got to take this on because Donald Trump, you'll be hearing this last week, several days ago, he finally announced his running mate. This dude named Mike Pence, who is the type of person that I didn't even know like existed anymore, who sort of looks like kind of like overgrown farm boy with kind of like plastic hair. Very kind of strange dude. Like, he's almost so normal he's not normal. He looks like the guy like at the end of the movie, like the suburban uncle who all of a sudden becomes like an axe murderer. And basically, what we're focusing on is not just the whole brand F up that is Donald Trump and that is everything involved in this, but we might get to that too. But specifically the logo. Because when they announced this, they dropped a logo. You know, there's kind of like the red, white, and blue. There's a little bit of American flag action going on. But what caught everybody's attention was you had the Trump T for Trump, dropping in on an open P. I mean, am I describing this correctly?
Yeah.
The best way I could describe it is...
The T is deeply penetrating the P.
The T. So basically, Donald Trump is asserting, even in the logo, that like, Mike, you're subservient to me. You're pathetic. It was like, the other day we were joking around, Mike Pence is going to be Trump, be like, what am I, your monkey? And he's going to be like, Mike, that's exactly what you are. You're my monkey. And so we could call this a brand F up, but maybe Donald Trump is setting the table and establishing clear boundaries in this relationship right out of the gate through that logo.
That's a fact. And, you know, which it's the entire campaign season, people have been coming out with, like, you know, logos like Jeb with the exclamation point.
Jeb exclamation point.
There's the trust Ted, right?
Yeah. No.
Which doubles his trust. It's just like people have been dropping these weird logos. And then, you know, in comes Donald Trump, of course, and the first letter of his last name is having sex with something in his logo. Like, it's just... It's just so weird, man. And then, you know, because everything has to be American flag branded, so it's red, white, and blue. It's like a play on the, you know, the stars and stripes. It's like, it just, you could tell, like, whoever came up with this in the meeting, they were, like, high-fiving. They were like, this is incredible. Look at this. It's a T and a P, and it's together. They're just melted. It's one mind melt. But, of course, it ended
I'm literally
disaster.
Raping yeah. Mike. I love it.
Yeah, all this of this fantastic. Stuff is, needs a tremendous rebrand. I think, like, there's an incredible opportunity for, like, all people involved in politics to just, like, hire real creative agencies. Like, let's turn this into a plus-plus for those in creative circles. Because, like you said, all of these ads, they always look like, if you go through a history book at, like, old 1892.
Of course.
Posters and branding, it looks like we've gone no further. It's just that they're like computer made instead of like drawn on a right. piece of paper. It's embarrassing.
Or just the idea that an exclamation point could get me excited about your campaign. Like, that'll get them excited.
That'll do the trick. You use the right, like, that's like
the right font.
I like that. That'll get them excited. That's his jab.
But you,
jab!
Know, you know who knocked it out the park? Obama.
Yeah.
And his first was run, his branding was incredible. And he kind of set the table. So I guess, you know, maybe our expectations are a little bit too high when it comes to a guy like Donald Trump or Jeb Bush, who I'm sleeping right. I almost fell asleep. Sorry. Yeah. You know.
But I think what's interesting about that, though, is that, you know, in the Jeb Bush case, what's great about that is that it's like the biggest, it's almost like the new Coke of politics, because that dude, like, hundreds of millions of dollars raised. I mean, it's this massive behemoth corporate failure product launch. Yeah. And that's fundamentally because the product sucks, so you can't do anything. But, you know, I'm just talking purely performatively, you know, without even getting into the policy stuff. Dude cannot campaign.
Right.
What's funny about Trump is that this whole campaign is kind of like a scam. So I think that, like, barely any money in the bank account. There's all sorts of double dipping on who's getting contracts and who's getting hired. So they're going to, I feel like it's going to come out like, it wasn't even some like whack political consulting firm. It's going to be like Trump's like steak maker's son's girlfriend put together a logo. And then there was a check that was cut and half rebated back to Trump's estate in Florida. And that's what I love about this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can tell there was no real thought about this at all.
There hasn't been a lot of thought to anything he's done, really.
Yeah.
It's kind of just by the seat of his pants, and it's like, everything I do works. So why would this be any different?
I mean, look, it's great. You know, but the thing is, the last thing I'd say, though, is I don't know, you know, because I read this profile of him, like, around the time Iowa, when all the mainstream press all of a sudden were like, wait a second, this is actually real. Even though, like, people like me had been like, yeah, this is pretty fucking real. Like, he's going to win. And they did a profile where they talked about how back in 2014, he had a meeting with these top, like, New York Republicans. And they were actually going to try to get him to run for governor of New York, which would have been hilarious. And he was like, no, I'm going to run for president. And they're like, okay, well, you need to, you know, raise X amount of money. You need to staff up in this way. And he's like, no, I think I'm going to get free media just by talking. And they're like, that never happens. The estimates, I think, are literally in the billions. Yeah. In terms of free earned media that he's gotten. So I think the thing with Trump is that it is by the seat of his pants, and I would never overinflate them. Like, he is basically a dumb dude, but he has instincts.
Of course.
And the instincts have been working,
he's
you know?
Like a shark.
Yeah,
he's sharks a shark. Have instincts.
Yeah, exactly.
The instinct.
Yeah. But not as bloated. Sharks a little more fit.
It's obvious to me that he's like, if you just listen to conservative talk radio.
Yep.
You know what kind of numbers those guys do, guys like Limbaugh or Hugh Hewitt and all these other dudes. If you know that there's a huge audience for that, and none of that ever gets covered on CNN or MSNBC or even Fox. Like, Fox is where they put on their sort of polite faces. Yeah. On radio is where they really, like,
they go
this
in.
Is where I get busy. So if you know what's happening in that world and it's not being covered on TV, and you bring that to TV, he knows what's going to sell, and he knows those people eat that stuff up. Yeah. From the way he speaks about people, like to just come out and say a judge can't be impartial because they're Mexican, like,
and being Mexican's a good thing. Like, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but he can't be my judge.
But you know, people will, like, people on CNN will be like, how could you say something like that? But it's like, that's what how they talk on conservative talk radio. And he knows that. He knows who his audience is. And so he definitely has an instinct for who's listening to him, who's going to, you know, eat this stuff up. And that's why he can say what he wants, because there's already been a baseline established for that. You know, where people could sit around and say, well, you know, the Clintons used to sell cocaine. No evidence. They can just go on their program and say whatever.
They murdered people. All the conspiracy theories. It's incredible. Love that stuff.
And then when they tried to take them down, you know, the party bigwigs, the people in charge tried to take them down. They'd like, don't you people know what facts are? And it's like, no.
No. Of course not.
No. No, they can't tell what's fact from fiction anymore, because that's how people have been getting over for years. And Trump knows this. He knows he can say whatever he wants. All that matters is how he says it. If he says it in a manner that speaks to those people, then he's good. It doesn't matter how true it is. Yes, pretty much.
We partner with the Cali cartel, not Medellin.
And you know what I love now is, you know, his pivot. Or his lack of
I don't
of
know
a
if that's really happening.
That's what I'm saying. Like, they're like, no, he's gonna moderate his message. He's like, why would I do that? I've got all of these people eating out the palm of my hand. Even if I don't win the presidency, I'll always have these people.
He can start his own. The most valid rumor I've heard is that the real plan is that this is all a setup for his own media empire,
which is genius,
which makes total sense.
Which is genius. He's probably looking at Breitbart like, oh, you guys are small potatoes. We could take this to the stratosphere.
We could, you know what? Instead of like on Fox, it's just sort of boring, and then all these other sites are staffed by kids who look like they have Down syndrome. We could really do something amazing here. It's true. Can make a fantastic, glorious neo-Nazi website. All right, so. Actually, the logo is a brand F up, but apparently the whole other thing has been a brand success with terrible people. All right, let's get to what's up. All right, so now we got to get to what's up. And Waz, I want you to lead us on this journey. We're talking about NBA salary cap.
Yeah.
We're talking about future of sports in this, and we're talking about why are Americans always obsessed with the players and not the owners when it comes to money?
Right. So, you know, to bring it back about, I want to say a little bit more than a year ago, the NBA renegotiated their TV deal with Turner and ESPN. This deal is $24 billion. The deal before that was $930 million.
Oh, shit.
So,
wow. That's an insane gap.
It's a jump.
Yeah, that's a real
jump. Okay, so NBA free agency is still going on. And, you know, they've basically set records for contracts handed out. And there's been, you know, there's been a lot of chatter amongst fans, even amongst media who actually understood and knew this was coming, at how surprised they've been at the numbers involved with some of the contracts. It's not that a guy like maybe Kevin Durant is getting $27 million annually. It's a guy like Harrison Barnes who was... He's a decent player.
Garbage.
Right?
Yeah, but he's getting in the finals.
Yes. And he's getting $22, $23 million. But where, you know, previously that was reserved for only the top, the upper crust of the NBA. So people are confused by this. But in October of 2014, the NBA announced a deal, a brand new deal with Turner Sports and ESPN for $24 billion over the next 9 years, which comes out to roughly $2.6 billion annually.
Damn.
For some context, the previous deal that they had with ESPN and Turner was for $930 million. So you go from $930 million to $26 billion. That's, I mean, I'm no mathematician, but that's a huge jump. And the way their labor agreement, the collective bargaining agreement is set up, the players get 51% of all basketball related revenue. The owners get 49%. So when you see players getting, say, a Mike Conley, you know, because my older brother, when he saw that Mike Conley got a contract for $153 million, he was astounded.
What did he say?
He was just like, Mike Conley's going to make $31 million a year? That's what Jordan made. That's his exact, you know, those were his exact words to me. And, you know, which... I get it. You see something like that, and if you're somebody who has what we like to call a regular job, right? And you see a dude making $31 million annually, and you're like, this guy's never even made an all-star team. It's confusing. But what I would tell them is, if Mike Conley's getting if he's able to earn a $150 million contract, and he's splitting that pie with 300 other players, and the owners get 49% of the money, what do you think James Dolan is getting?
Right.
If his owner can afford to pay him $153 million, that's because he's making a lot more than that. But nobody would ever ask for the owners to give money back. It's always, well, we think the workers should give money back. And I get it to a certain extent in that, as a fan, you view everything through the prism of the team. So your interests are aligned with ownership, ultimately. Mm. Right? Like, you want the Knicks to spend as little as possible on whoever they get so that they can bring in more players.
It'll make no difference.
Yeah. As a Knicks fan, I'm like...
Maybe that was a bad example.
Yeah. I agree. I think the owners... But I'm probably opposite of that in a way, because I'm never on the owner's side.
I'm the same.
I always feel like the owners are the absolute worst.
Of course.
I don't care about them at all.
Always.
You know, I'm always on the player's side. But there's nuance in that I want the Knicks to spend as much money as they can, but I want them to spend it wisely.
Yeah, of course.
And unfortunately, they spend it terribly.
And of course, you know, another part of the problem, which is not a problem, but it's just a system... The system that the owners themselves have negotiated and designed, they artificially cap the amount a player can make. So there's what you call a max contract. Somebody like LeBron James, depending on how many years you've been in the NBA and what the salary cap is for that season, there's a cap on how much you can make. Whereas in an open market, if LeBron James, if people were just able to bid on him,
right.
There's no way he would only get $30 million a year. He might get $65, $75.
Most definitely.
So
definitely.
If you artificially cap the contracts of players, this money has to go to other places. And now that's where you see a guy like Harrison Barnes can go out and get himself a $95 million contract, even though he's 5-for-32 the last three games of the NBA Finals. And so, you
know, it
was
sad. I mean, look.
It was pathetic.
Frankly, it was pathetic.
Quite
it was a mess.
Frankly.
It was a mess. And I don't want to be the one to say
it. I just feel like the fans, they just, a lot of times they don't apply this sort of context. It's just like, that guy doesn't deserve what he's getting.
But that's the question, right?
Right.
Because when you look at, like, especially, like, if you take this globally and you look at, like, you know, as an example, like, some of, like, you know, like, Russian oligarch money in the UK, like, straight up, and I'm not saying there's anything particular about Russian oligarchs. I'm just saying this stuff has become a lot rarer in terms of, like, what owners can do, and we see it all over the United States in terms of extorting localities around tax breaks for stadiums and everything else. I mean, it's a brutal exploitive game. And then, yeah, it's almost like they can play a double game with the players, where it's like, of course they're never going to get the same glory because they're not actually really doing anything. But then they're still out there with the trophy and the champagne.
Of course. And
then at the same, but then all the heat for the money gets turned on the players. And then I mean, there's the why do we identify with management. There's definitely the racial aspect. And then there's also the aspect of like, by the way, points for me to being the first one to bring that up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to get to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure you were. Yeah, I know. That's why I want to preempt
and
it.
And I want
to
say
But I
want
to say the
too.
Third thing real quick, yeah, too, sorry. Though, is that like, is this refusal to also be real about what sports are. Like, people, I think, still on some level want to keep kind of like, there's some conversation of like, yeah, well, those are like adults who get to play games for a living. And it's like, right, games that involve hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue
and employ thousands
of people and are sort of like seminal to every aspect of our culture. So right. You got to decide, you know, because if that's really how you feel about it, then don't buy the tickets. Don't watch it. But you're not going to do that. So then you got to be honest about what this actually represents in your life.
You can make choices about how you interact with sports. Like right. to the race element, you know, particularly in sports where you're close to the action. Like when you go to a basketball game and you're like, and you have decent seats and these you're kind of in it, it's terrible.
Damn near naked, by the way. No, seriously.
No, I know.
Seriously. I know. Like, the especially in basketball, you're so close to the... It's not like football where these guys have all this armor on. They have a helmet on. There's no real identification there.
Yeah.
But in basketball, you're literally just watching these guys perform. And you can see them in all their humanity. But I want to get back to this idea of identifying with ownership. Because, you know, a lot of times when I go online, right, and I'm... Cause I'm you know, I'm a secret commie. I don't like the owners. I don't like they're getting 40. The players get 51% of the money now. I wish they were getting 60% or 65%.
It used to be higher. They used to get 57.
It was 57.
But when they had the last
CBA, the owners smacked them in the head and you know, and ultimately got some money back. And you know, when I talk about the players as workers, people just don't. They just don't accept that these guys are workers. That's what they are. And the bottom line is, a guy like Mike Conley has put in more work as far as perfecting his craft of basketball, the hours, the sacrifice. He's dedicated his life to this. There is nothing else for him in life besides basketball. And the average person hasn't put in a quarter of the time that Mike Conley has put into playing basketball. So this idea that he doesn't deserve his money, but James Dolan, who inherited the damn team from his father, is more deserving.
Well, he made a good sperm and egg call, yo. You gotta think long term. That's a businessman right there.
The famous line from the Clint Eastwood movie Unforgiven is that deserves got nothing to do with it. And like Jalen Rose would always say, is not what you're worth, is what you can negotiate.
Of course.
And I'm like, any player out there, negotiate to get every dime.
Yeah.
Every dime you can get it. Because your playing time, A, is finite. So you have a shorter window of time to maximize your earning potential over the course of any particular contract. And the owners, they gonna make that money. Because most of the time, it's not even their primary way they make money.
Most of them.
That's just a way for them to kind of like floss.
Have some vanity. But also what I'm sure, but like, is the idea that regardless of what sector you work in, that if you just hit a certain level of income, you're not a worker anymore? Like, that to me is the other thing that's just erroneous about it. Worker and owner just describes a relationship.
Right.
Whether you're talking about $10 an hour or $20 million a year, it's the same reality that someone's labor is getting used to extract to make somebody else a profit.
Right.
And that's not really even a moral judgment. That's just the reality.
That's just a fact.
So you don't hit a certain income level and then all of a sudden escape from that dynamic. Well, you can be more or less privileged, obviously, and it's real privilege to be an NBA star. That's
of
great.
Of course.
But you're a worker by definition. So that shows, again, that we can't get definitions right.
Right.
And it's like, because it's not about a moral judgment. I might say they deserve, you know, be a fucking one of these annoying people. Like, if a teacher makes $100,000 a year, Michael Jordan should make $90,000 a year. Like, whatever, cool. Sure. Say whatever the fuck you want to say.
Sure.
I don't happen to believe that personally.
Right.
I believe teachers should get paid less. No, I'm just playing. Apologies, Majority Report people. I do not believe that. But I'm just saying, it's not about all those subjective things. There is just a certain objective relationship that seems to just get completely lost when you throw a certain dollar figure at it.
And again, the idea that we just were, and you know, to even get back to Donald Trump, a lot of people love him just for the fact that he's rich. There is no interrogation of, did he earn this money?
No.
Does he deserve this money?
No.
It's just he has money, so therefore he deserved it. But it's hard. And you know, a lot of times when I say they, I'm talking about the viewing public, which is majority white. Right. When we talk about fan culture, sports culture, when we talk about, oh, we want our athletes to be humble, to be pious. Nobody says that shit at my barbershop.
Yeah, nobody gives a shit.
I've never heard.
Really?
I've never heard.
You know, they're like, wouldn't it be great if they just started being a little bit more respectable? That's because I've been to your barbershop. That's what I heard. Maybe they talk that way in front of me.
Look, I've never. First of all, I've never heard anybody at my barbershop use the term arrogance.
Yeah,
he's just so arrogant the way he won that game. I thought it was arrogant.
And that viewing public likes the coded words.
Of
like,
course,
act like you've been there before.
Yeah, stop hot dogging it.
Yeah.
And you know, and a part of me, and I tell
play
people
the game
this
the right way.
I tell people this all the time. I'm like, you can dance, you can celebrate if you're an athlete. You just can't be good at it, right? Like when you like fans don't mind Steph Curry dancing because he's just goofy. Not that good goofy. At it. But when Cam Newton is dabbing and he's doing all of this, he's a really good dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, like people just reject that because I mean I have my own theory because it's black. Right? Like, dancing good is a black thing. So it's like, people just stop showboating, stop doing that. And again, like, when I say they, I mean the viewing public, which is overwhelmingly white people. And these values that we ascribe to what our ideal athlete would have, that's just not the reality of people that I've grown up with.
And those are those double standards. Yeah. Like Gronkowski,
of course.
He's a fun, party, wild guy, you know, like after the Patriots thankfully lost their Super Bowl to the Giants.
Clap it up.
And
clap
he
it
was
up
out.
For the Patriots losing.
You know, he was out like partying that night.
Fuck
people,
you.
People
fuck
try you. To hang him. Like people were cool with it.
Of course.
They're like, oh, it's okay for him to be out kicking it after they lost the Super Bowl. If it was like another athlete, they'd have been like, oh my God, doesn't he care?
Right.
You know, look at him. He's out partying after they lost. Like, that just shows.
Even with, you know, Cam Newton, too, who me, he, like, crystallizes the entire situation, right? People feel like, oh, quarterbacks shouldn't act like that. But I've never heard anybody complain about Aaron Rodgers. He does a goddamn pelvic thrust. His little discount double check thing. He does that all the time. He's always celebrating. He's always rubbing it in. Nobody cares.
And getting checks for it.
Exactly. So, you know, and I think that's most of what we're seeing here in the
Aaron Rodgers
player dynamic.
Exuberant.
Right.
I don't know what the problem is.
You know, and
I'm just going to be that dude for the rest of the show.
You hear people
stop
say,
stop blaming Aaron Rodgers for enjoying himself on the field. What is this, a Nation of Islam meeting? Trying to talk about sports.
Well, you know, Michael, Aaron Rodgers, of course, is what they call relatable, right?
I find Aaron Rodgers, I would like him to come over to my home, have intercourse with my daughter.
Like, I hear people say, well, Steph Curry, he's relatable. He's you know, comparatively small. He's a shorter dude. He seems like an everyman. I'm like, Larry Bird was 6'8". Somehow they found him relatable.
I think the thing about Larry Bird and Steph Curry is, I think
you just can't relate to LeBron.
I feel like both Steph Curry and Larry Bird would not try to rob me.
And there you have it.
I'll be providing subtext for the rest of the program. That's what's up. Let's get to what's good.
Now we're ready to jump into what's good. And what's good is actually what's not so good if you're a promoter dealing with festivals and concerts, because recently it's come out, and we're going to quote a little bit from a recent Stereo Gum article by Peter Hellman, that Bonnaroo, which is a rock folk festival event that happens in Tennessee every year, it's one of the larger festival events, actually had a pretty steep decline in ticket sales this year and actually hit an all-time low. Just to quote a little bit from the article, Bonnaroo sold 45,000 tickets this year, which is 28,000 fewer than the year before, and a $9 million drop in revenue from the festival high, which was 2011. So I think what this does is put us in a position to ask a couple of questions. Have we kind of reached a peak in festivals? You know, Coachella is a coming-of-age event in Southern California. Thousands and thousands of people go to that every year. It's covered pretty broadly. There's also Electronic Daisy Festival, which is another huge event. But you are seeing sort of a consolidation in the festival's face. So I'm asking, you know, are we seeing peak festival? And what does this mean for music at a time when streaming is more and more of a thing? Do artists have a reliable stream through live music? Or is that something that's also going away?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before, you know, how basically, like, that was the theory, right? The theory was that as revenue from sales of actual, I mean, certainly we're past the point of physical, so we're not even talking about that anymore. So if we're talking about, you know, revenue from streaming services and downloads, then if that's going to continue to decrease and decrease and the whole market of music has been disrupted, we're going to have a rebound on the other side in terms of live shows. And you know, in spite of these kind of setbacks, I know that there's still a lot of conversations about reinventing that experience. And I know we're going to get to that in a minute on virtual reality and stuff like that. But it just does seem like basic big picture on this. It parallels so many other conversations we have from, you know, the interview we have with Rana Faruhar on finance and on like the kind of arteries of the American economy. And then many conversations we've had on like BuzzFeed Motion Picture and how to actually get paid in what we call, you know, this cultural economy we're in. And, you know, the money is there. It's just not filtering. And instead of getting at the big challenges of reinventing new models, we keep looking for these silver bullets. Like, okay, well, if it's not going to be streaming, it'll be at the shows. If it's not going to be at the shows, maybe it'll be virtual reality. None of those little fixes are going to fundamentally kind of orient how to actually create more sort of sustainability and durability in music.
I kind of want to push back on the peak festival idea a little bit, because in New York City alone, we've got Governor's Ball, we've got Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival, we've got
Panorama,
we've got the North Side, the thing in Williamsburg Festival, and actually there's this new festival that's popped up called The Meadows, which they're doing it in at Flushing Meadow Park in October. I think a good friend of mine is actually booked for that. That's kind of the only reason I know about it. But
let's go.
They got I'm going.
Let's do it.
I'm going. But they have Kanye West headlining. A whole bunch of other big acts. And a part of me wonders if Bonnaroo is suffering from, if you lived in the Northeast and you wanted to go to a big festival, you either had to go to Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, which is in Chicago, I believe, or Coachella. Now you have Made in America, which in Philadelphia, which I actually have attended a bunch of times. That's only a 2-hour drive from here. You know, you got Governor's Ball. You have now The Meadows. You have all of these options now. So a part of me is wondering, because I've personally known people who have made the pilgrimage to Bonnaroo because they wanted to get that festival feel. Because Governor's Ball is a festival, but like, you know, it's not quite the same experience, right? And, you know, and there's also, oh my goodness, what's this EDM? EDC, they have that out here in Giant Stadium. So there's a huge option, especially if you're in the Northeast now, to where you might not have to travel quite as far as you used to. Because I'm like, if there's no money in these festivals, why do they just keep popping up?
Bingo.
No, especially out here. Now, as far as, and I'm a little bit close to the situation because I have a close friend of mine who's signed to a major record label, right? And, you know, you get your little advance, but you have to get creative about how you're able to make money, because you're not selling your physical copies, like you guys said. It's all about streaming, but, you know, it's about live show revenue. It's about, you know, they got this thing where they do meet and greets straight up. Like, you give us $200, you can come meet me and hang out with me, you know, which isn't a new concept. But, you know, as far as merch is concerned, that you have to get really creative as an artist if you want to extract money out of this. And, you know, some people are getting smart about corporate sponsorships, things like that. But again, like, it's not going to be just, I go to the studio, I make an album, I put it out, and I go on the road. It's not going to be that anymore. As you said, you mentioned the virtual reality. I've heard that that's, you know, going to be a part of the future. Like, you watch, you know, you watch Jay-Z's show on Oculus, which, you know, again, to me, maybe I'm kind of old school. You know, a big part of going to something like a concert is the other people, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, being in the environment of, you know, fellow fans who are going just as crazy as you. Like, I can remember the first time I saw Odd Future in concert. And, you know, I was kind of lukewarm about their music, But the experience of being around those kids who were like slam dancing and literally moshing, like there were girls elbowing people in the throat. Like, I'm not even joking. So like that experience, you can't simulate that from your couch with an Oculus. So no. I think there'll always be the live show, you know, revenue stream. But you definitely have to get a lot more creative with what you're doing now.
And I think festivals and concerts, they're never going to go away. Like, I think peak festival for me meant sort of the proliferation of festivals being everywhere.
Right.
And now I think what you're seeing is a little bit of a condensing. You mentioned geography. That's a big part of it. You know, obviously, if you're in the tri-state area or close East Coast, like Philly, D.C., yes. what have you, you can make these sort of quicker trips than you can to a place like Tennessee.
Right.
I think Bonnaroo very specifically suffers from just a lack of interest in, like, let's call it just general rock.
Right.
You know, yeah. whereas, like, I dig all kinds of shit, so right. I could, like, yeah, I would fuck with going to see Pearl Jam and all those kind of bands, of but I'm not really going to go to Tennessee to do it if right. I could catch them someplace closer. As you were talking, there's a couple of things that I thought about in that the festival experience or large-scale concert experience, because some of them are not all multi-day festivals. Right. I think about this idea of like niche, you know, people going really deep into a particular area rather than broad, trying to catch as many general fans as possible. And there's two festivals that came to mind. One is Afropunk, which started yeah. here in Brooklyn, and now it's in London, it's in Amsterdam, it's in Paris. And I think they speak to a very particular audience that is sort of underrepresented in the festival concert space. It's alternative black music. And as much as I hate alternative,
yeah.
you know, it's music that white people don't think black people like.
Right.
And then the other one
you
I
guys
mentioned.
Like that shit?
Yeah, can you believe it? Like
I have no
guitars
idea.
And things like that. Like,
I thought that the guitar was kryptonite to you people.
No. But the other quick festival I'll mention, because one of my boys is a part of it, Modi, so shout out to Modi, is Trelectro.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. you know,
that's in D.C.
They're in D.C. And they started that festival, I think, in a very smart way because it combined like elements of EDM, elements of hip hop, as those musics kind of fused a little bit in right. terms of sound. And it's in a market that was at the time underrepresented as D.C., but has a heavy contingent of college kids
yeah, and
right
black
around
professionals,
there.
Too.
Yeah.
Do you think, though, that like that's like because you're pointing out. Yeah, that it's not necessarily peak festival. It's peak, like, maybe certain genres. But I also think, like, there's certain types of experiences that for me, like, I love going to concerts. I love going to festivals. But there's, like, diminishing returns on a certain type of, like, what I would associate with a Bonnaroo-esque experience. Like, being in a big field and, like, mashed up and just like, all right, this is cool, but
there's mud.
I get the fuck out of here.
Like, hippies, my,
like,
shit, a lot of
like things smell. My shoes are getting too scuffed up. I think I like want to. I would prefer at this moment to be on that Oculus, and that's the first time I'll ever say anything like that in my life because I'm not really prone to that type of thing at all. So I think it's like, is it just the sort of parallel with everything else where it's like, even we see like these little pop ups in different places, like in you know. Various cities of like you'll notice it's very underneath the surface, but it's a little bit of a signal of like we're gonna have a DVD store come back or we're gonna have a CD place and some type of physical interaction. But you can't just have like a you know it's not a Blockbuster's not gonna come back, but you can have like we do Hong Kong action flicks and we know everything about it and we sell posters and there's some other shit associated with it. So is it that festivals and as artists have to think about reinventing the wheel and how they're going to make it, that it's just going to get, and that's the parallel I make with everything else where I say like less big shows that predominate, less one single source, you know, places that people go, and just more and more like these kind of micro proliferations where it's, you got to create a specific type of experience. It's not just a geography or a genre. You have to create a certain particular kind of community around
you
it.
You definitely have to rock the experience.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking it's also like if you want to, and this is where like the business of festivals, like if you're going to put out, they're all such huge events now, the economics of like booking the space, booking the artist, putting all of that together – now that's where you need, like, if you think, if you look, go back, let's say 5-6 years, or maybe a little bit more, and you look at the artists that were like headlining Coachella, they were not the artists that are headlining Coachella now.
Well, that's what I wanted to get at.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned underserved communities. Like, anybody who's ever been involved with promotions or booking, it's a problem if your event is considered black, right? Like, everybody's always afraid to book something where they think a lot of black people are going to show up. And so, you know, and I remember my first time going to Made in America, I was like, well, this is, it's, which is essentially, it's Budweiser's yeah. festival, but they got Jay-Z to curate it. And I remember looking at the bill and I was like, wow, there's a lot of black people on this bill. And that's why I wanted to go, you know, but anytime you're involved with booking something and, you know, there's hip hop or any kind of situation where, you know, it's expected that a lot of black people are going to show up, people are more reticent to do those things. And I think that's...
Not sure if I'm going to the Budweiser Festival this year. Shit always works. Fucking deaf comedy jam voice.
But,
it's so resilient.
But yeah, and I think that's what you're probably going to see now. You're just going to see, like... You know, let's try to get some black people here. That's the only way.
But I think with like Afropunk, and if we took it to any other kind of like, you know, segment or demographic,
right? Which isn't Afropunk isn't exactly a summer jam.
No, not at all. Not at all. But the point more being that you need to be even more specific than that. Now.
Right.
You can't even just say like you need to really curate a very specific experience to like even more than a broad category like black people.
Right.
Well, what are they into?
Right.
What's the aesthetic? What's the sound like?
Like,
and I think that is, and also, you know, again, on like the rock or alternative or what the fuck, you know, like that whole tip as well. That sound and that aesthetic has shifted a lot well.
On the flip,
yeah,
to the rock stuff is sort of weird in that rock space because you have like Bonnaroo, which kind of mainstream.
Right.
Rock,
right.
Whatever.
Bonnaroo is the quote unquote mainstream.
But if you go the other extreme, and these are bands I've never really been into, but there's a bunch of like really super like hardcore speed metal type bands like Slipknot.
Yep.
And like Slipknot has a festival that they do. I think it's called like Fortnot Festival or something like that. I might be getting the name wrong, but like they have like their own sort of like they go out on the road with a bunch of those kind of hardcore.
And that's what
bands.
I mean. That's
and,
a very specific community, though.
That kills every year.
And that's what I'm saying. Because they've identified
who
that
people are.
Very particular. Like, that isn't just, like, white kids who like rock, if we're doing that thing. Because we're always going after the sloppy demographics of all of it. And that's another great example of, like, you know, white kids who like rock doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
What, like, what's the, you know, a black show... Like, it can mean something in terms of what you're talking about, like the racial problems around, like, oh, it's a black show, whatever. But that's real. But at the same time, like, what the fuck is it? I don't know what a black show is. You know what I mean?
Like, if you go out to Afropunk, that crowd is
right, but see,
diverse.
This is the problem. This is the problem.
And the styles of music and the presentation and the aesthetic is always
like,
different.
Mike, you can make these delineations because you actually think about culture. The gatekeepers don't think like that.
That's
like,
our whole, that's why Hire Dope Boys, available.
Like, they don't think that way. Because in reality, what's Rihanna's demographic? It's everybody.
Of course.
Right?
Right.
Like, she's a black artist. She makes black music. She also makes really poppy stuff. But, like, her demo is everything. Yep. Even a Jay-Z or a Kanye, like, their demo is everybody. But, you know, a lot of times... If you're associated with rap music, let's face it, people just assume that you're just going to only attract, you know, ghetto black people that are going to shoot you up.
Right. No. And that was right. No. And that's because we talk all the time of like redefining even just like the pantheon. Like it's shit. Like you could have a conversation. Where it's like Nas, Neil Young, Jay-Z, fucking Bob Dylan, Peter Tosh, whatever. Yeah. Like. Cross all of that nonsense because you're just talking about like the pantheon of people who do good shit.
Right.
Yeah.
And I do think that there is an impulse towards that as well, however small that may be. Definitely. I do think like to the extent we're going to talk demographically, that's a positive millennial thing to a certain degree. It's trendy now to think more in those terms. Right. Like it's like I got the like the Nirvana shirts popped up all of a sudden.
Right.
People like, you know, you see a lot of black dudes like rocking a Nirvana shirt. Of course. And that used to be like the stereotype was back in the 90s that like, you know, Nirvana is like Pacific Northwest and blue, you know, acid wash blue jeans, and that's white people. And then black people have Bad Boy and Death Row. And then in reality, I think even then everybody was actually kind of listening to everything. Yep. And now it's just getting more formalized, which is a really, to the extent there's a positive signal in this, I think it's that.
Definitely, definitely. The more specific you can be in, I think that niche, if we want to call it that, there is an advantage in doing that. I remember when Afropunk got like Janelle Monae, I was like, damn, yeah, they booked Janelle Monae. Like, right, that was sort of big for them. And I think she's one of those artists who lives in so many different worlds, right, just based off her creativity. And they historically, they went back and pulled in like, you know, Bad Brains and Living Color. Like, right, you can see that this team understood the culture in which they were speaking to get all these people out there, you know, and now it's expanded. And so I think from that perspective, the Peak Festival is sort of a way to gin us up, yeah, but there's a little bit more when you dig in there. But Bonnaroo, they should maybe take some examples from like these Slipknot dudes and try to figure out like how to speak a little bit more authentically.
I think a lot of times people don't think that you can put Slipknot on the same bill as Jay-Z. Like, you can do that.
You totally can do that.
You know what I'm saying? Like, totally. It doesn't, you don't have to necessarily, like something like Afropunk, which, you know, me and my friends, we joke, we call like that crowd like Afropunk, something like Everyday People. Which, you know, the homies do. We call that the Shea Butter crowd.
Yeah. You know, we used to call it O&Bs.
Yeah.
Oil and Berries.
And, you know, and...
Wait, is that coming to America?
Yeah.
Like, only fruit and berries.
Yeah. My whole crew would be like, yo, the O&Bs is out in full effect.
You know, and
I don't treat it with products.
And you know, the funny thing is that's just an aesthetic, right? It's not, it doesn't actually mean anything. Right. Like, these same people listen to trap music, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no
it's
doubt.
Just an aesthetic. But, you know, once you identify who your crowd is, you can do whatever you want at the end of the day. Because I just saw that they booked Tyler, the Creator, speaking of, you know, Odd Future. And I was like, man, are those Shea Butter chicks ready to slam dance?
Yeah.
I don't know. You know what I'm saying? But they did, but they booked them. Because they know, like, you know, our people are going to come out and they're going to have a good time. And I think that's kind of the lesson there for me. Because, you know, a lot of times if you're not actually thinking about these things on a more deeper level, if you're just doing surface level with anything, you won't think to book Tyler, the Creator. It's just important to get a lot deeper than, well, it's not Erykah Badu. You know what I'm saying? Like, you gotta get past that.
Eric keeps getting the checks from the O&Bs.
Love to Erykah.
Patron saint of the O&Bs.
And love to her. And love to hippies, I gotta say, too.
No doubt.
Love to hippies and shower. All right.
And that's what's good.
We gotta get to the crates. Phil, you want to start?
My crates is a year. 1988. This is one of my...
We're getting really abstract now.
Yeah,
I love
dude,
it.
Super abstract. But it's actually going to drill down to music. This is one of my favorite musical years ever because I think 1988 was one of these watersheds in sort of the black music experience, at least for me. I was in high school and three albums came out that were so different that really... to impacted my life and really I think showed so much of the like just the our ability to fit into so many different worlds that people stereotypically might not think we fit into. The first record is Public Enemies. It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Still one of my favorite records ever. I remember when I literally bought the album, I was totally PE down. So that was released in 1988. Living Color, which is a rock band, released their first album, Vivid. That's also an amazing record. And then finally, Tracy Chapman's self-titled album, Tracy Chapman, which from a folk perspective, like I think now if that album came out, we'd lump it in with a bunch of other records that sort of this alternative folk, and that's kind of become a thing. But I think back of you, 1988, in such a heavy hip hop R&B world, at least from like black radio, to have Tracy Chapman's first record come out, and it was such a fast car with such a huge hit, talking about a revolution, and then one of her songs became like a huge reggae hit for those who know reggae music. So that's my crates, 1988, as typified by those three albums.
Dope.
You ready, man?
Yeah. I didn't really have to dig too deep in the crates, seeing as this album came out like last week. But I want to recommend this Schoolboy Q album. It's called Blank Face. For those of you who aren't too familiar with Schoolboy, he's part of TDE / Black Hippie. He's the more, I want to say, ratchet member of the crew, you know, whereas Kendrick is more of a, you know, sort of a conscious dude. He has a reputation for being conscious, super lyrical. I guess Ab Soul is more of like the stoner type of dude of the crew. J-Rock is like the older dude. And Schoolboy is just a young, kind of a little bit wild, like he's an ex-gang member, ex-drug dealer, ex-pimp even. And you get a lot of that on the album, but he's also, I think he's actually sneakily really conscious too, in that he can speak on things like gang banging and drug dealing, but you can tell he speaks from the oh, shit.
I was going to say, you're trying to give yourself a little that bed there.
That was an accident. But you can tell that he speaks from the perspective of somebody who knows better, you know. And a couple of tracks that I would like to recommend to folks. He's got a song called Ride Out with Vince Staples, who's another Southern California dude. Really good lyricist. Really good with cadence, really good with flow. I'm a big Staples guy. He's a young dude. I'm a fan of a lot of what he's put out. And he's got a song with SZA called Never Change. Those are the two I'd recommend. SZA's actually also a TDE artist. She's there, I guess, singer, you know. Yeah, I really like the album. Oxymoron was cool. I was kind of disappointed because I'm really a big fan of Schoolboy. I was expecting something else. But Blank Face is definitely a must listen.
All right, so after you read my pick, you should go listen to some Schoolboy at a party. Impress. But mentioned this a couple weeks ago, this book by Jeremy Rifkin called The End of Work, which came out in the mid-1990s. And I did want to use it for the crates this week because I do think, and I know he has more recent books on zero marginal cost and everything else. So really kind of, I guess you could just sort of pick whichever one you want to go with. But End of Work, if you set aside some of the examples from the 90s or whatever, obviously being, you know, of that era, it was a book that really mapped out the reality of the employment situation and where we were going. And I also like it because, again, I'm not, you know, worried about being too nerdy or too technical, in the sense that I'm sure he got some things wrong, and I'm sure that, you know, you could pick apart this or that, but he did actually identify a trend which now everybody is kind of accepting in terms of automation, in terms of post-work economy, which at the time was sort of roundly dismissed by kind of mainstream economists. Like, no, this tech bubble is going to create the next, you know, industrial revolution of jobs, which is, you know, I think we're all kind of coming to grips with the reality that that's not the case. And he mapped it out in the book. He said, look, we can have a post-work economy of useless, of wasted lives and mass inequality, which is, you know, where we've been going and doing. Or we can reinvent the whole idea of what we think work is and what we think creation is. And we can create a massive, you know, social infrastructure and social safety net. And people can go out and actually do a lot of things that really need to be done. I mean, he was already talking about infrastructure and things like that. So it's a good book. It's on point. The End of Work by Jeremy Rifkin. Then go out and party. And then wake up to discover you've been replaced by a robot, apparently. No, I'm just playing. I'm not trying to be negative. Super producer Matt Leck, thank you so much. The Power Behind the Throne, intern Charmaine, thank you. She's silent but deadly on a PowerPoint. Wise, thanks for coming by, man.
Thanks for having me, guys. This was a lot of fun.
Obviously, we got to do this again soon.
Yes,
no doubt.
Absolutely. All right.
Thanks, brother.
Thank you.